Welcome to the Market Genius AI podcast. This is our leaders edition of the show, where we hear from go-to-market leaders on navigating careers and trends, what makes leaders great, and how to win in go-to-market.
So in this episode, our guest is Seamus Ruiz Earle, Managing Director and Founder of Revenue Operations and Technologies at Carabiner. It's great to have you. I can't wait for this conversation and learn more about the company itself, also about your thoughts and the story behind acquisition by SBI. So let's dive in.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, and I'm excited for us to be doing our first Leaders podcast episode and to have you be joining us for it. So yeah, I want to hear a little bit about how you got started in the industry and what motivated you to establish Carabiner.
The origin story, so to speak, is a bit of a roundabout one, so I'll try to make it quick. But the long story short is I wanted to be an investment banker in high school. And really it was, I looked at the list of top paying professions. Investment banker was up there, surgeon, engineer. I'm like, I'm not good at math. I'm not good at science. Okay, banker, I can do that. And decided, all right, that's what I wanted to be. And I cold called a whole bunch of investment banks when I was 17, trying to get a job as an intern. And all of them said the same thing of sort of come back later once you're of age. And the 27th or 28th answered the phone and said, actually, we love the fact that you're calling us and that you're trying to get a gig. You can't touch the financial services stuff because there's SEC compliance rules against that. But if you learn Salesforce, we need to move our internal systems from Salesforce Classic to Salesforce Lightning. And there's this great thing called Salesforce Trailhead, which you can take for free in your home and you can learn how to do it. And if you get the badges and do the things you need to do, we'll let you come in and help us with that process.
For free.
For free at the beginning. That was the whole thing. I started by teaching myself Salesforce in order to get the investment banking job. And once I got there, they did start to pay me. It was great. And I really enjoyed it. And I was good at it. And I got hooked up with Salesforce Corporate. I ended up speaking at Dreamforce when I was 18 and experienced that crazy zeitgeist of humanity. And then long story short is I decided to transition away from the investment banking and into consulting. And I got a job with Deloitte in their Salesforce practice fresh out of school. That was sort of the plan. But then there was this little thing called the COVID-19 pandemic. The world shut down. I got sent home and my start date was delayed by 9 months. And so instead of just hanging around watching Netflix, I had 90K in student loan debt and I had the Salesforce skill set and I wanted to try and pay off my student loans. So I started doing Salesforce consulting to pass the time. And it just so happened everybody needed it at the right time. And, you know, I had to hire 3 or 4 people within a couple of months in order to keep up with demand. And that was how the company was started. And the rest, as they say, is sort of history. We grew really fast. We expanded into revenue operations. We're the first to do RevOps as a service. And then in May of 24, sold the firm to a company called SBI that does large-scale strategy consulting for 100 million to a billion in revenue customers. And now we're a part of that family.
You got back into that consulting world. I had a similar dream as an 18-year-old to become a doctor. And I took my first biology course in college, and I was like, I think I'm going to go into communications. I don't think I'm cut out for this world. So we make it one way or another. I want to double click a little bit into that scaling journey. And here, you know, we heard a little bit about the early days of how you got started, but what was the process of scaling up? I know you hired a couple of people, but could you share a little bit more of how that journey went?
The beginning, it was finding clients every which way, trying to dial in an offering that people wanted. And for me, the thing that was scary was that most of this work was being done was project-based, right? So people would pay you $5,000 or something, which seems like a lot to a 20-year-old kid, but you can't hire somebody to do that work on a full-time basis on just $5,000, right? You got to fill out the funnel with, you know, 10 $5,000 projects every month just to keep the lights on. And so the real key in Unlock really came from my risk aversion, which was, hey, I'd much rather you pay me, say, $10,000 for a year's worth of service versus $5,000 for 3 months. Because at least on the $10,000 option, I know that I'm getting whatever that is, $750 a month on a regular forecastable, you know,
basis,
ready
yep.
stream. And then I can grow off of that was sort of the thesis. That was my foundational growth. And so, you know, the real key and unlock was going down this subscription model, this managed service model, that we were able to onboard a client, make 30% operating profit instead of 50%, and keep them for a very long time and get them to renew instead of just being a one and done, you know, maximize your earn out on the one client and have to go find another. And so the first year we did about $1 million in gross receipts, the second year about 4.3, and kept scaling from there. That was kind of the journey.
How did you find your first few clients? Because I feel like that's always the hard part. You already obviously had with that investment banking some what of a resume, right? So that's helpful. But how did 1, 2, 3, 5 come in?
I think it was two things. It was cost and it was, shall we say, willingness to take anything, right? And so cost was great because I was living at home, no mortgage, no family, no nothing. I always in conversations like this take a point to say like I was enormously privileged in this scenario, right? Of like I had a job waiting for me, I had food being prepared, living with my family, like all of these things are really, you know, pros. But as a result, I was able to charge $15 or $20 an hour compared to the lowest competitors who were charging, say, $100 an hour. And even when you see a 20-year-old kid who's saying, yeah, you know, I'll do this for $20 an hour, you look at the resume, you're pretty sure they can do it okay. You're like, a fifth of the cost? Of course I'll give them a shot, right? Yeah. So we started there and we got opportunities through platforms like Upwork, you know, LinkedIn job postings and that sort of thing where people were raising their hand actively and saying, hey, I need help with this stuff. And then just being competitive with our bids at first. And then again, it works if it's a subscription, right? It works if you're able to get the ongoing project basis because your $300 client turns into $3,000 client over, you know, a 5-month period.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. This is my first puppy podcast pop up. So that's Camper.
Everyone is welcome.
Yeah. So we talk to a fair amount of service companies on this podcast. The pricing model is definitely, I think, a differentiator. What else do you think differentiated Carabiner or still does differentiate what you guys do?
The model was what it was originally. We probably got to the middle of our second year when we started to realize, hey, this revenue operations movement is happening. This RevOps movement is happening. And so co-opting that and making that a key part of our offering and saying, hey, we're not just a Salesforce SI. We're a Salesforce plus HubSpot, Salesforce Oracle, Salesforce plus Marketo, Salesforce plus NetSuite, Salesforce plus 150 other tools, right? Each of which is hard to manage and challenging and you got to get value out of, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We're all of those things and we're going to help you with your go-to-market process and make sure that it mirrors what you actually need. You know, that was just such a foreign concept to the market and it was so much what people were looking for. That was the real unlock to help us grow from just growing 30-40% to growing 400%.
Not coming and fixing one platform problem, but fixing all of the platforms that obviously need to rely on each other and are integrated with each other is really what differentiated you.
A holistic sort of ecosystem, right?
Yeah. And do you think that was a big, obviously, it's a huge thing to be acquired as a service company and to be acquired by someone like SBI. Do you think that's what really brought them to the table with you guys and where you were able to get the acquisition through?
Well, I think, you know, speaking candidly, there's probably two pieces to it. One is we were very good at what we did, what we do. So we were sort of the quadrant leader on G2 and we had a really strong brand and, you know, we spent a lot of time and money and energy on building a reputation in the industry of doing good work, right? So that was one piece, was the quality quotient was quite high. The other piece was, I see this all the time with agency owners, is an inflated sense of value, right? And by value, I don't mean self-worth or value that you're providing to clients, but physically, like the enterprise value of what your company is worth, right? And I'm fortunate we spent 4 years doing this. You know, I owned the business outright. Didn't raise any capital. So for me, at 24 years old, in order to get an exit, you know, in a meaningful, you know, high seven-figure range is game-changing, right? Yeah. And so I was willing to play ball, frankly, in a way that a lot of people who had invested, say, anything more than that, 11 years of their life, 12 years of their life, whatever, and, you know, sort of were treating it like a lifestyle business, wouldn't have been willing to do, right? I see sort of a bigger picture to this where we now get access to, you know, 8 of the top 10 private equity firms in the world. And we get to work with a bigger, larger company. We get a greater sense of security and stability. We get to have an exit under our belt. We get all of these different things that help set us up for whatever's next. And, you know, the reality is that I think knowing now what I do about previous processes that are acquire, head run, folks just don't recognize sometimes the value of those things compared to just the dollar value of what a deal would need to be in order to get them interested.
You looked at it as like a growth opportunity. Like, how can we continue to scale this with the backing of SBI? And so what are you focused on now as part of SBI? What is Carabiner focused on, and kind of how do you fit into the overall SBI strategy?
Well, I think revenue operations isn't going anywhere, right? And so now the beauty of where we're sitting now is that we have access to a large firm of strategy resources who do some of the most complex and incredible work on go-to-market that exists. And we combine that with world-class tactical excellence in terms of how do you go and execute those things. So everything from, hey, we need to go design a new org chart. Well, that has ramifications on 4 different systems, the territory roll-ups, how they're going to do global variable comp, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so knowing that and recognizing that, we're now in a really unique place of being able to help engineer multi-billion dollar mergers and acquisitions from a systems perspective, as well as serving our core customer base of Series A, B, C SaaS companies with world-class strategy work, right? That they would never have had to do before because these people bill out at high hourly rates. And so we're able to get that access for our customers in ways that they never would have been able to have. So it's just a really interesting sort of Venn diagram of solutions. And I think it's, you know, so far it's worked exceptionally well.
Yeah. And that's a big differentiator for you as a services business to be able to tap into some of those other resources as well, I'm sure.
Absolutely. And it just brings a whole different perspective, right? We can say, hey, we've been there and done that, right? We're bringing you from 15 million in revenue to 50 million in revenue to 500 million in revenue. And here are the proof points. Here's the resume that supports that versus an agency that might have to work for 20 years to get that breadth of experience. We got there in 4 and change, and we co-opted the rest.
Yeah, absolutely. What was the biggest thing you learned through this process?
So many things. Gosh.
You can give me a couple, but
maybe the biggest thing that comes to mind right off the bat is the how important people are and how disruptive people are all at the same time. Right? It's very sexy and it's funny through the 20s and the 21 and the 22 conversations. The thing that companies would talk about is how fast they were growing, how much money they had raised, and how many people they had. Very rarely was it, oh, my gross profit margin increased from 70 to 85% because of some efficiencies, or I'm now trending at 35% EBITDA margins and pulling down a million or two a year in cash flow. Like, people were talking about, oh no, I went from 10 to 100 people. I was doing it. Everybody was doing it. That's what people indexed on. And what I didn't realize was that those 50 people that we hired at one point, right? We were 50 people, 40 people, 45 people, something like that at our height. Like, they are human beings and they have dependents and they have, if you are empathetic at all as a human, right? And as a leader, that adds way more stress to your life, and let alone the inter-office interactions that you have to deal with, right? People have personalities versus running a business. You know, I think we're seeing it sort of we're transitioning into trends a little bit here, but we're seeing businesses grow now with a much lower footprint of human. And so I just didn't index on the right things, I think, growing, because the whole thing in the media that you hear about is like, how fast is your company growing? And it's all about humans and how much money you've raised. And so I think that was one piece. And then maybe the second piece was just, sounds sort of silly, but it's worth noting. Just because you sign a contract with somebody doesn't mean they have to honor said contract. I feel like that's a lesson that everybody learns the hard way, when you're a kid or you're going through school or you're growing up, it's like, oh, you're signing something. You're signing a document that says you're going to do something. You think that there's going to be consequences if you don't. And you're like, there can be, but it's also far easier to break a contractual agreement than I ever thought possible. We had a number of clients, particularly through the SVB collapse and subsequent funding rounds, just say, nope, we're not going to pay you. We owe you $100,000. We're not going to pay you. Or, you know, we're breaking our contract here. We're breaking your contract there. And I was totally naive to that even being a possibility and what it would take to sue somebody and sort of, you know, try to elicit the funds back and send them to collections and all of that whole thing.
The unfun part of business. Yeah, I think the first thing you shared on is a lesson that many of us have learned over the past couple of years as things have changed from growth at all costs to profitability. Anyone that's been working in the industry or other industries for a while, like your first postmortem where you're like, how did things go so wrong, is an experience that you don't get until you're in the working world and can really feel it firsthand.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. The only thing about the challenges that provide some sort of recompense for me is that at least you're learning through them. Or it feels like you're learning through them, right? Like there are really tactical things, tactical takeaways that we learned through this process that, you know, at SBI I'm using. And as we move forward into whatever, you know, long-term, you know, opportunities I choose to pursue will 100% come back to, you know, be utilized. And at least, you know, there's some takeaway from the pain of making those mistakes along the way.
Yeah. Mistakes can be learned from.
Yeah, exactly. I think these are the foundations of the business that you're learning. This is unfortunate that you have to learn them in those conditions, but you're going to carry this for, you know, even your private life, right? Like, I think the decisions you're going to make, you're going to make them based off that too. That's where I've learned at the beginning of my career that, okay, a lot of that actually is, you can transfer that to the real life.
Totally agree with you.
Yeah. So let's dive a little bit into the services and tech trends. The first thing that comes to my mind I want to ask you about is this great transition from, you know, somewhat fractional work that became a consulting, very much embedded into services that, you know, has a successful exit, right? Like you don't hear a lot of these stories from the co-founders and founders, right? Like usually it's about tech, it's about the product. So what was your motivation to stay within the services? You never thought about changing and flipping into the product space, figuring out, okay, I can build this little app over here or there?
Well, I think there were two pieces to that decision. One is I don't know how to do it. So, you know, everything that we do today and did before, there are ways that I can jump in to help if something happens or, you know, we're operating from a basis of known skill set. So that's one piece. And the second piece is that services businesses, better or worse, are usually 90% of circumstances much simpler from a investment to return thesis in that it's a cash flowing business from day one. Because really, I'm marketing my own time. My cost of goods is zero. Right. And, you know, if I get paid $20 an hour and it's just my time, well, then that's $40,000 a year in revenue right there, you know, on a standard 2000 hour work year. And so my point being is that we're not talking about hiring a developer for 2 years before we get to a MVP or a year until you get to an MVP and sinking in 100 or 200 or 500 grand, let alone anything more than that. Right. Like successful products take millions and millions of dollars to develop before you see anything. And that can be scary from a cash flow perspective. The other reason is that we port all of our cash into growth. So brand, marketing, growth accelerants, you know, we went from nothing to 6 or 7 million in ARR in 2 or 3 years. And that was, we didn't take money out of the business in that entire time. It all got funneled back in order to grow. And that's what got us to a point of being exitable rather than being a cash flow business that, you know, you pull out $1 million a year out of, great, but then you're growing at 10% a year. Inflation adjusted 7% a year. Not nearly as sexy, not nearly as acquirable, and not nearly as high an exit multiple, most likely.
The interesting thing is you kind of ran the service business as a tech business, right? Like that's what tech businesses tend to do. They figure out how to charge a SaaS model because that's the most sustainable future-proof revenue. And then you reinvest your profit, which is interesting.
I also was really, really clear along the way. I think a lot of services businesses are tied to people's personal brands. And in our case, that really wasn't the case, right? Like, I don't know how many LinkedIn followers. I have 13,000 LinkedIn followers or something like that. I'm not 130,000. I'm not Sam Jacobs over here. You know, my brand is Carabiner Group. Carabiner Group is known, not Seamus as much, right? Like, I'm known, but that's not the point of the business. The business is separable from myself in a way that most services businesses are not. I'm not even talking operationally. I'm talking about like sales and marketing style of stuff, right? There's a lot of people who can do Salesforce consulting or GovOps consulting that I could hire to replace me from that role. For most agency owners or services businesses, the piece that is irreplaceable is them as part of the go-to-market motion, which in that world, why would I buy it if I can't lock you down too? And even if I can, why would I pay you a super high multiple? Because at some point you're going to leave. And it's a lot messier versus running a self-sustaining business.
I think it's a good point about the key asset and what you're buying, right? Usually it's either know-how or contracts. So either you have some unique processes or ways or methods that are scalable in this case, or yeah, you have a lot of customers, right? That somebody can just bring another services and not add on top. Still, I think services is much harder to scale than product. That's why I think a lot of people just maybe struggle, maybe just using this, like you said, is just a way of life. But you rarely see the success like this. You build the asset that actually is around the brand and the company itself instead of associating with a specific skill that you bring to the table, right? There's some community of people that already are part of that brand and they contribute, but everyone is somewhat replaceable. So that's a really unique approach. Yeah, I like that.
I guess the only pushback I'll have on that is that that's what the narrative is. Services is hard to scale. And yet I don't buy that. Like that has not been my experience and it's not been the experience of a lot of the more successful agency owners. I think it's the model. Can you focus enough on structure and to your point, methodology and offering? What helped us grow so fast was the reality that we were able to sell $100,000, $200,000 contracts at 10 to 20% margin. Instead of $5,000 contracts at 50% margin. $5,000 contracts at 50% margin is fantastic if you're able to get 200 of them a month or something, right? But I would much rather close three $300,000 contracts at 20% and structure it differently, right? And I think that's the thing about entrepreneurship and model and agency owning that really, really matters more than anything else. Is it repeatable? And if there are a large enough TAM that you're able to go after that you have a unique value proposition for, because I see so many people struggling to your point, they get to a million, they get to 2 million, but it's because their offering itself is not dialed to be mainstream enough that they can go out there and sit at a dinner table and say, oh, anybody here need a RevOps help, need help configuring Salesforce? Everybody in the room raises their hand, right? Because everybody has that problem. I think offering, I guess is my point, is what is the key to scaling a services business.
Yeah, I think you got to be also specific what you're really good at and double down on this because you think to your point, there's a TAM, there's enough to dig in and also share the market, right? Because that's another piece, right? If there's not enough to share the market with others, that means there's something wrong with your idea. So let's shift a little bit into kind of the tech companies and maybe your customer side of your business. You know, I'm just curious to hear your opinion about new ways of scaling startups today, right? So, of course, the environment is changing a lot, right? So we have we have this AI coming in. You know, some people are scared, some people are reluctant. You have a mixed bag of everything, but apparently, big tech is just staying on course, right? Like the layoffs are real. This is happening. You know, we're both living here in Silicon Valley, so we just hear this every day, right? There's something going on. So how do you see kind of the new ways of scaling startups today, maybe going forward?
Two things that I'm seeing. One is usage-based pricing. Boon or a bane, curse or a benefit type of thing, right? If you can figure out a way to do it as a company, it's one of the biggest game changers that you can unlock. Like, my next thing will for sure be usage-based. I want as low of a barrier to entry as possible. And I think that's what people don't realize about it, is that it's an immense opportunity to expand your TAM. So that's step one. The other thing that I'm seeing, particularly around AI, is that everybody is interested in it, but no one knows how to do it yet at scale, really, right? The enablement around it is the most challenging part. Which tool do I buy? How do I use it? And not just how do I use it, but how do I use it for my company and my use case I need? Because it's different than a CRM, right? Or it's different from a marketing automation tool. The actual applications of AI now, to be most successful, I think require a much more bespoke approach compared to, like, here's the 11 ways to use it inside of an accounting business.
Yeah, I think AI is only as good as the information that feeds into it. We've seen a lot of AI agents, and I think those are fine and helpful, but that's not really like the dream or promise of AI. And then I think on your consumption-based model, who do you think is doing this well? Like, HubSpot has always been my example of being really good at having low prices to get SMBs in that will grow with them. Not consumption-based, but low enough. And I'm struggling to think of someone who's like cracked the code on this, but I might not be looking at the right platforms either.
I think that the ones who have done it the best that I have seen are, it's actually like Google Cloud.
Great example.
The AWS credit thing. And to be fair, it's a large, you know, those are large companies who can afford to absorb the cost, et cetera, right? But you think about the value provided through a purse, you know, it's sort of as usage-based, right? And that you're not paying a platform fee for Google Cloud, you're paying per seat. A 5-person company can get the same suite of tools that a 3,000-person company can run off of. That's a remarkably high value proposition when you think about it, right? Like, so things like that, and then the credit-based tools that exist out there, right? That, you know, have existed and have always existed last 20 years or so around, you know, the platforms that folks are building on. I think we can learn a lot from looking at those models as we move into this new era of what's worked for them. May not work carbon copy, but it'll likely work similarly. And I think that's what we're seeing now with like Agentforce on the Salesforce ecosystem, as we're making a big shift towards consumption-based pricing, and still, you know, yet to see the full impacts of all of this stuff, but, you know, early signs are coming.
Yeah, I think there's something to say about the data usage. That's that any company that is doing something around the data or selling data or providing data or is providing service that it, you know, consumes or is driving the cost based on data usage, I think it's well positioned to adjust that. I think I'm always skeptical is the companies that build the features that are not volume based and then they're value based. So that transition might be painful. And I think for a while, I feel like we're going to have a little bit of a combination between the subscription and consumption that is coming on top, which complicates the pricing. I agree. That's never good for pricing because that should be easy. Definitely that's going to be probably somewhere in a kind of transitional period.
And you think about it, it changes a lot, right? Yeah. ARR, recurring revenue. How do you calculate that now? And how do you compensate on that now, right? I see a lot more shift towards the wealth management compensation model, AUM type of thing. You're building a book of business. You own that book of business, growing that book of business and scaling it together. I think it's going to be totally disruptive and you're going to have to like figure a way out of this now. I think it's going to align incentives a lot more inside of orgs, but it's going to be very disruptive where 400K OTE, you know, SaaS sellers who were hunter killers, right? Like they go out and bring in the bacon.
The big whales. Yeah.
That's not the model anymore, really. Like it's more, can you build a relationship and grow it over time? Different skill sets, different pieces of tech to support that motion. The ramifications are broad.
It's interesting because I work in advertising or for an ad platform that we also have a account-based marketing features to it. And for the last 5 years, it's been like, how do we get more ARR revenue into a media platform? But buying media is inherently consumption-based, right? It's CPM-based. That's how it's always been with sellers, of you build this relationship and you grow it over time and you hope to upsell them to higher budgets. And so where we had been struggling the past 5 years of SaaS and ARR, and now it's like, oh, this is easy for us to do. I feel like the wealth management advertising are going to come into play and kind of be models for how do you set up compensation.
Yeah, and we can always borrow some of these models from the other businesses, like annuity-based compensation is very popular in some industries. So definitely that can be a model, can be recycled a lot of other places. But I still think the data is still, it's better positioned. And I agree with you on the disruption. I think it's going to have a profound impact on how we structure organizations. It will shift some of the responsibilities between the teams as well. Let's move into the AI, also the kind of the narrative that exists right now on the market. I mean, considering that you have a successful exit with the SBI, do you think that other companies that are planning exit, they have to have a very strong angle with the AI right now in order to be even considered for acquisition? Or that is something that will fizzle out very soon and that AI unnecessarily has to be somewhere baked in the narrative, how you develop product and how you also sell the product?
I think we're 10 years out from AI being like a key part of acquisition for services business. And the reason why is that I can buy a services business today that's doing, let's call it $3 million in revenue and $1 million in EBITDA. I can buy that probably for $5 to $6 million, depending on what the model is, maybe even less. And within 3 months, 6 months, turn it into doing $2.5 million in EBITDA through the use of AI. And so in all reality, there's going to be quite a lot of opportunity for people to do that transition themselves. Or people like me will buy your company and then create enterprise value and flip it to a private equity firm or do their own platform play or whatever. And so I actually think the key will be marketing yourself. If you don't want to do the AI transformation work, fine, get it. It's hard. It may not be everybody's skill set. You may not have the requisite knowledge or opportunity, whatever. It's to market yourself in the way that you become that prospect of saying, hey, I am ripe for this opportunity. Buy me now. Maybe even do majority and minority stake to reap the benefits of somebody with the expertise. And I think that's going to continue for the next 10 years or so. And then you probably won't be around in business at that point anyways, if you don't have an AI strategy, because you're not going to be able to compete against the folks who are.
So you think this is going to be like a 10 years, or could be five, or could be seven,
I know accountants who are still doing things on paper. So it really is highly dependent on industry. Textiles, manufacturing, consulting firms aren't going to be nearly as disrupted as software development. But I think within 10 years, you see the vast majority of industries being disrupted in a way that would cause pause for agencies operating in those environments.
Yeah, I've seen the PwC analysis at some point. They were looking at the kind of 7-10 years timeframe for almost any industry to transition and adopt AI. So that sounds reasonable. But let me ask you another question, which actually is a flip side of the same coin, and relates to hiring and the skills itself. There's a lot of people right now wondering, how I'm going to reskill, where I'm going to go from what I was doing till now for maybe 5-10 years. What would be the advice today for any individual that is trying to enter the go-to-market space? Anything for sellers, marketers, revenue operations, from your perspective, you think that they should be paying attention to or learn new skills?
If we want to go down that rabbit hole, I think there's a couple of different places that I would advise people to be thinking about. One is prompt engineering. The tools are only going to keep getting better, becoming more usable, et cetera. But I think the difference between somebody who is good at AI and great at AI is going to be how seamlessly you can integrate it into your day-to-day workflow, right? So can you become a 10x engineer because you're using tools in a very particular way? The use of those tools is what becomes proprietary, not the tool itself. And so a good analogy for that is like hedge fund operators. Everybody has access to the data. access. You can get access to the data about these companies and which way the stock is going or not going. But it's the analysis, it's the way you approach it and the models that you build around it. And the way you take those inputs and produce an output, that process is what makes you great or a failure, right? And so I think that same thing is going to be across the board with all roles that have to do with computers in any way, shape, or form. The other thing that I would say is that if you don't want to have to reskill again, pick something that is unlikely to change a whole lot in the next 20 to 25 years. And those are people businesses, like tourism, hospitality. There's a lot of transferable skill sets, I think, from some businesses into other businesses. I'm speaking primarily at this point to folks who have 10 to 15 years left in their career, and they're trying to get over that next hump to retirement. And in those industries, I think there's an awful lot that someone with some seasoned experience can bring to bear that isn't, how do I code or how do I click or how do I do these things? It's, how do I cater to a customer as part of a buyer journey? Like, that part isn't changing. Anyways, just pick your battles correctly. Not everybody needs to be a coder or a AI engineer. Some people just need to be able to understand how brains work and what motivations are and human psychology. And again, those things are going to evolve, but not at the same pace. And I think there's a lot more overlap there than people can realize sometimes.
So it sounds like sales job is not going away, according to your description. Yeah.
Not really, but the mix, right, is that sales and SaaS may change significantly. The way people buy a SaaS tool may change. The way people buy oil rig machinery, not changing for a long time, relatively speaking. You're still going to get in a pickup truck and drive out to South Texas and go from rig to rig to rig to rig, building relationships and handing out burritos. There's a large section of the world still that operates that way. And so, again, it's all dependent on timeline. I would not give the same advice to a 20-year-old kid, you know, just jumping out of school. But if you're a seasoned vet who knows what they're doing and knows how to sell, go pick an industry that still sells that way.
That's a good advice. I agree.
I always push people to get experience in tech businesses, because I think once you have worked at a tech business or in the tech industry for 10 years, you can go work for many other industries and be ahead of the curve, right? Because they're probably trying to transform their industry to be more tech forward, and you've already been doing it for however many years.
Exactly.
Knowing all things about the go-to-market today, right? You have a lot of extensive experience in that space. You know, you've been working with a lot of customers. A question that is nurturing me is, what do actually the go-to-market is missing today? So what do you think a go-to-market tech stack hasn't figured out yet? And I think there's probably plenty of experiences you have, and maybe, you know, you've seen over and over working on your projects with your customers that is still out there and is waiting for its solution.
I think we're not very good today at understanding the signals that indicate that someone is in a buying motion. So, like, if your TAM is 100 people, depending on the business, right, any 5 of them will be in buying mode at any one point in time. You need to market to the 100, but the 5 are the ones that you really care about at that critical 1 month, 90 week, you know, 90 day cycle.
Uh-huh.
And there's a whole bunch of tech around that tries to do it. But to this point, we're really not very good at saying, like, oh no, those are the 5. Those are the 5 that you really care about, that you need to go and reach out to and do your custom ABM and ABX style approaches to. And right now and there are obvious signals, right? Like, oh, we're buying a company, or we're divesting from a company, or there's a new CEO. Like, there's signals you can look for, and people do that, and they're very successful when they have those plays, more successful than they would be without it. But there isn't a foolproof way of doing that today. And I think that realistically, with the amount of content and data that gets put out from people online now, there's going to be tools and platforms that amalgamate those data sources that are even coming from individual consumers and cross-referencing that with company behavior to say, Lizzie's buying something right now, and I should go reach out to her with a gift card for Uber or whatever. Not even a gift card to Uber, but a gift card to the local neighborhood coffee shop that she really likes that she posted about on Facebook, because that's going to distinguish me from the whole crowd. I don't know. Like, that profile thing, Sixth Sense is trying. Like, you've just got all sorts of stuff that tries, and none of it that nails it. just yet.
Couldn't agree more. Well, I think the other piece of that is like, what does Lizzie want?
I haven't figured it out. But, you know, I know you for some time. Yeah.
Well, no, the perfect example of this is like, I often get Grubhub gift certificates because someone wants me to buy something. Well, I live in rural Vermont. There's no Grubhub here. And when I lived in New York City, that was great, but I don't live there anymore. So I don't care about that. And so I even think there's more work to be done, especially with more and more remote work around understanding the contact as well and what they want. So yeah, I think there's plenty of work to be done there.
So another question regarding personalization, because that's what we're talking about here. So AI definitely is giving us ability to operate at the different level of data aggregation, right? You have a meta, you have a like very individual, you definitely can see different buckets very quickly and can process that and have an output, right? So do you think the tools like Clearbit, Apollo, etc., these are the companies that are well positioned to solve that? Or you would expect to have other companies that will be a new entrance and going to take completely different approach to this and start solving the outbound messaging and kind of a website experiences and sales enablement content as well?
If I were betting man, I'd say it's new entrants. I don't actually don't love the platform play that everybody seems to ascribe to. I think you should do one thing and do it so exceptionally well that you own the market. And like at a certain point, you get too big and then you have to go platform. I get that. But like, I think that everybody's cap tables are going to be so screwed up. The incentive alignments are going to be so foobarred that we're going to get into a position where execs from leading companies are going to leave, start their own thing to solve a very specific problem and claim their corner of the earth and own it. And other entrants will try and edge in on the territory, but at a certain point, the quality, again, I think the whole thing is about unit economics now in a way that is very unique, right? It's like turn of the century, industrial revolution stuff. Like if we look back at that, there's a lot of parallels, but we're going to be able to see 1, 2, 3, 5 person companies get to $100 million in revenue in a way that we have not been able to do in human history, really, outside of art, outside of like stuff that has a different value creation model. That's a bit different. And in that world, I think point solution and quality over everything, community over everything, brand over everything is going to be the differentiator. And I think platforms are going to suffer.
We hear a lot about PLG, product-led growth, but I live in partnerships. So there's partner-led growth and we've seen that take off. And if you're thinking about really solving niche problems, well, you have a slew of tools that are integrated and other partners helping to sell those tools. What are you seeing with partner-led growth and are you seeing companies be successful with it?
Some yes, most no.
I would agree.
I think it takes a very specific company to run a partnership motion in a way that is successful. Or you need to make the incentive so stupid that people want to work with you. That's it. The nice thing about software is that your margins should be in a position where you can afford to give away 50% to a partner. This whole 10% bullshit, pardon my French, but like, why am I getting out of bed for 10%? I'm not going to go actively help you build a partner program for 10%. No. You give me 50%? Okay, that's different, right? Like, that's a real deal. I sell 100 grand worth of product. I get 50 grand to help my agency run better. Okay, now we're talking, right? And now we're in real conversation where it becomes a revenue source and you have partners who are engaged. But and like, I've literally never met any software vendor who has embraced that philosophy of like 50% plus. It's kind of crazy to me because enterprise value-wise, if they were to do that, it would have enormous impact on their enterprise value growth because they'd have agencies hawking their wares all over the place. The closest that I have seen, and it's why we've sold hundreds of thousands of dollars of Formstack product, is Formstack. Formstack has a tiered process, but they have a 30% revenue share for life of customers that you sell on their behalf. And they also refer professional services work back to you to implement. And we now are the number one Formstack partner, and we invest a lot of money and time and energy and have a division just towards that. And again, we've brought them a number of very large customers, and it's been a great deal. Zach Pines is a genius who runs that program, but that's so unique. So unique.
That's another name we should bring on our pod, Lizzie. So actually, I agree with you, but I also want to say that to your earlier point, the companies will be more efficient and faster accelerating towards these high returns so that they can actually afford sharing the revenue with the partners. But here's a catch. I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but a lot of industries or segments, when there is a service partner is living off the service. So for them, even 50% reselling, it's not a primary incentive. For them is to install something or put something as a part of the system and then live off that augmentation, maintenance, adjustments, you know, call it standby, whatever that is adding more revenue.
I disagree.
Wait.
I think.
And then when you're doing the technical, that's definitely a reseller, right? A typical reseller. And that's where it's working like beautifully. But yeah, please, Lizzie, you disagree with me.
It depends on what industry you're talking about. But I think a lot of agencies look at referral fees as a revenue source and they can take a price and go and resell it for higher. And that's a lot better margin than a human that is going to go and do something. And then on the advertising side, like they live off rebates. So I do think it's a pretty high revenue stream for agencies. But Seamus, obviously want to hear your opinion since you do this.
I think you both have a point, right? Am I going to go build my business around a 10 cents on the dollar revenue stream? No. 50 cents on the dollar is higher margins than the services work.
Yeah.
And I have access to customers and I can do it and it's recurring and it has a lot of different benefits for an agency owner. But what happens is so many people screw around with the software industry and they change, they settle, a lot of them settle at either 10 or 20%. And I get it. You want to maintain your margin profile, like you want to do these things. But if you're trying to grow and if you're trying to get access to people and access to, and you went and raised money on a burn rate anyways, why would you not try to go for the viral approach? Like I have literally never understood this. If I do ever do a product company, I will 100% be doing 50% revenue share up to, I don't know, 10 or 20 million in ARR, and then I'll start changing them all.
Target has that strategy, right? They're making 50% margin on every single product they're selling.
Costco takes zero margin effectively off of everything that they sell in that warehouse. It's all membership fees. That's where their profit comes from. They break even on everything else and lose money on the food in order to drive people into that place, and then they make their money back on the membership. If you actually look at their P&L and the way it all works out. And they're an enormously successful business.
Right? And continue to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, what is the profile? How are you building your financial profile for a business? That's really all it.
I could talk about my love for Costco, I think, for an entire hour. As someone who's been in partnerships for a long time and has tried to get referral fees to be higher and have the company be more generous, like the most effective thing a company can do is basically you look at what a cost of a salesperson is and what they bring in. And what is the margin you're paying a salesperson and account managers to maintain this client. And when you look at like the ramp period of a salesperson, the benefits you're paying them, the salary, the commission, everything, and you compare that to what you would pay an agency to go and resell this for you, I mean, you could be paying 50%. Easily. I think that's the thing companies really have to think about.
You're right. I don't think it's something that comes to mind. They try to do their fancy CAC to LTV ratios and they index on that when by the very nature of early stage startups, what LTV? There's not LTV until you're a 20-year enterprise company and you can see the trend lines.
A certain volume of customers, and then definitely you have to have at least a couple of years because otherwise it doesn't make sense to even...
Well, but even measure. If it's a couple of years, right? Like most CAC to LTV ratios end up being, oh, they're going to renew, like we're going to see 10% churn year over year. That means you're going to retain a customer for 10 years. You haven't been around for 10 years. How do you test that thesis?
And then there's an intangible value too of like, when a salesperson goes out and tries to sell your product, they have to build trust with whoever they're selling to. Most likely the reseller agency already has trust with a client to be able to go and sell this. And that's like something that sometimes people have a hard time understanding, that trust is a big part of the sales process.
Without the trust, there's even no business. You touched a little bit about kind of how the entire business model is changing because of the AI and the pricing. Do you think that multi-thread engagement model will change as well? What I mean by that is, like, you're selling to the CTO, but you're at the same time selling to the CFO. You want to have multi-thread conversations at the same time while you're selling to enterprise business, and that's almost needed. But do you think this is about to change, or this is going to stay as is?
I don't have a strong opinion on this, is my actual answer. I think it's likely to stay the same.
Okay.
I just think the stakeholder universe is going to shrink. You're going to have three co-founders who run a business worth $100 million, and you got to convince all three of them. But right now, you already have to convince...
way more than that.
11 plus, that's what the data says. It's 11 plus minimum to sell to enterprise.
Yeah. I guess it also depends on definition of enterprise, right? Like, I think that's going to change moving forward. I think revenue is not going to be a good band for what enterprise actually means. It's going to be more of an organizational complexity moniker than a revenue banding or a funding raise or whatever, or number of customers even. Again, all of this being narrowed in on tech in particular.
Do you think that the tools that are helping with that today, like Clary Gong, anything that is helping to identify the right conversations with the right stakeholders, they going to change as well, or are they going to stay the same?
No, they're going to evolve. They're all evolving now. They're evolving rapidly. Gong, we're very good partners with Gong. We do quite a lot of work with them. I think Clary is actually very far behind the times on a lot of this stuff. But to the point before about jobs and skills and everything, like, I don't think we're going to get to a world where one person's AI is going to talk to the other person's AI and they're going to negotiate price and, like, do value prop assessment. Like, there's still humans involved in this process. So it's identifying how do you cater to that human better, easier, in a more personable way.
How do you build that trust? Absolutely.
Or to your point, co-opt it, right?
Yes. Yes.
I want to plug something that real quick, because this is an interesting point, a really interesting segue. So there's an AI tool that I'm an advisor of that a good friend of mine started called Fluency. Jesse Shipman, who's big in the partnership ecosystem.
I know Jesse Shipman very well. She was a podcast guest.
Okay. So Jesse and I sort of came up with the modern version of Fluency over drinks in Banff, Canada, in -17-degree weather. We started talking about this exact thesis of, like, man, I'm an agency owner and I've got all of these partners, but I never know how to introduce the partners or when the right time is, because I'm not in every conversation. I've got 35 people who are doing that. And, you know, lo and behold, she goes and builds this incredible AI tool to help people co-opt that trust at scale. I think we're going to see more and more of those types of tools and those types of platforms gain market share, because that's what people are really going to care about. Anyways.
No, that's a valid point. Yeah.
We should have Jesse back on, because I've been along the ride with her as this has gone through. And I think AI is kind of the game changer for what she's been trying to build, and will help her build what she's wanted. So that's super exciting. I need to check back in with her. Anyone else that you want to call out in the industry that you think is doing cool things, either service or tech tools in the space?
I'll leave it there in terms of my plugs for the day. It's funny because it is so much about co-opting trust, right? And I think that the folks who are doing partnership really well, the folks who are doing brand really well, like, take a look at those folks. The only other thing that I would say is like, I think it really depends on what outcome you're going for. I saw a post on LinkedIn this week about somebody taking a pot shot at Adam Robinson saying, you know, this is great if you're selling to $10 million SaaS companies. It's not going to fly if you're selling to $1 billion enterprises. And I'm like, yep, I'm 100% in agreement, right? If you know anything about Adam's style, right, and how he goes out and does it, great, incredible, like, building awesome businesses that will get to a certain point, but established companies aren't going to buy that way. And so I think that matters too, of what goal are you trying to get to? Do you want a $5 million ARR business? Do you want a $100 million ARR business? Those are things that are going to change the way that you need to go to market and build your companies moving forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And it'll be interesting to see how that evolves with AI and where and when it can be implemented. Last but not least, what top three tips are you going to leave us with?
Oh, golly. For anything?
Maybe skip a couple of topics. Okay.
Top one is Factor Meals. Get a meal prep service. That's number one.
And Factor is the best because you don't have to do anything. And you can, if you don't have a microwave, you can also heat it up in the oven, which is very hard to find in meals.
Now I know it was advertised on the 101 last night when I was taking a drive from San Francisco.
That's number one. I was targeting you. There you go. Hey. That's your
personalized,
multi-touch attribution.
Personalized ad coming from these AI-based apps.
So that's number one. Number two is, if you're ever flying into New York, highly recommend taking Blade helicopters into the city. It's $195 per seat to go into the city. And so if you're by yourself, jump on the helicopter. It's the coolest way to go into Manhattan. And an Uber is like $120. So just eat the extra $70. It's well worth it.
Where do you land?
East 23rd or West 30th heliports. Okay. Highly recommend. I do it every time I'm in the city. And then last but not least is, if you have to invest anywhere in a company setting, invest in brand. I think brand is the one thing that is unbuyable quickly. And I think that it's the one thing that is protectable and defensible against rapid AI growth, technology change, economy change, all of those things.
I've never had a top three tip speak more to my heart and soul as somebody who works with performance advertisers, and we're always convincing them to do brand awareness spend. Couldn't agree more. I love efficient travel and I have Factor Meals. So you just nailed it, Seamus. Thank you.
The full holistic tip base.
I love it. Well, thank you so much for your time today and sharing your thoughts on things. It was great to have you on.
Thank you.
Great to chat with you, everybody.